I don't know. You know, they talked on there about clothes lasting for 3 years. I don't know what it is. That is a rare thing for me to ever have clothes that last a year, even. Maybe it's something I exude, but they almost disintegrate as I'm wearing it. It's a bizarre. My brother, on the other hand, he can wear clothes. I don't know. He never gets it. I remember in the late 80s, we had to stage an intervention to take away his platform shoes and his plaid bell bottoms. But for normal humans, you know, stuff wears out and we move on. We feel the passage of time. You know, my daughter gave it away, but I feel the passage of time. Never mind. You don't know what we talk about with wines and all that kind of stuff. The aging is a good thing. But we feel the passage of time in a lot of ways. And you feel it in the bodies that we inhabit and stuff. You know, we're having a family celebration this week. Robbie and her sister both turned 50. And so she's got a ton of family. This whole section over here, these rowdy people, it's her family over here. And we've been going back through old photos and things and reminiscing about times. And we see that all things change. I mean, we can mark that. That's really what time becomes for us. One of those means by which we mark the changes that take place. Things change, things shift, and ultimately, things cease. But we don't think about that kind of stuff when we're young. We don't think about life ceasing when we're young. Why would we? We got all these plans. We got all this stuff that we're going to do. We never think about how transitory this life is, right? I mean, when you were young, did you think of that? Those of you who aren't young anymore, my people. Yet it's the inescapable nature of life on this plane that it's temporary. And there's so many twists and turns in life. Not only is it temporary, but things rarely ever turn out the way that we plan. So as we journey here, it becomes very apparent to us that we're not in control of time and events. And that's an uncomfortable idea to wrestle with. It really is, to think that we can't control the time that we have or the events that we experience. But really, it's a very healthy thing to do, to wrestle with that and come to grips with that if we want to have a healthy view of our lives that we have right here and right now. Now, we're coming back to our study in James, and if you've got a way of following along, if you'd head over to James chapter 4, please. The continuing theme started here back in chapter 3 that is the theme of humility. We talked last week about James's approach, God's approach to conflict resolution. We're embracing God's plan for sacrificial love and humility is the means by which we can navigate through relational issues that come up. And now today, with humility still in view here, James is going to pull back and tackle the larger subject of life in general. Or better put, he's going to encourage us to have a proper view of life's uncertainties so that we can make the most out of the life that we have right now. To make the most of this. Because as human beings, we have a great deal of trouble living in the present moment. I don't know if you've noticed that over time, but we have a great deal of difficulty living right here and now. We'll either live in the past, thinking, obsessing about the past, whether we're becoming nostalgic over it or whether we're wallowing in regrets from it, or we'll forecast out into a future, either optimistically or fearfully, but we rarely ever focus on where we are right now, right here, which is, you know, an odd kind of thing, because this is really the only life that we have for sure. We're all alive sitting in this room, and that's what we got. That's what we know for sure. But everything else is fraught with a lot of uncertainties. So how can we make the most of our right now? How can we make the most of this moment even that we have right here? How can we gain a perspective on an uncertain future and the uncertain nature of this physical life that we have so that it's going to affect our attitudes and our behaviors in a positive kind of way? Well, that's what James is going to be discussing with us this morning. So if you're there in chapter 4 of James, let's pick up where we left off last time, starting in verse 13. James says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we'll go into such and such a town and we'll spend a year there and we'll trade and we'll make a profit. Yet you don't know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. All right, we'll stop there for a second. James begins with a phrase that's actually unique to his writing here. It says, come now. And as best as we can tell, it's an imperative. He's trying to get our attention with something. James is really blunt, so we probably should have, you know, translated like, listen up or something like that. Because that's the gist of it. And he's calling attention to people who apparently are just conducting normal business operations or plans. He's describing them as arranging to set up a trade and expand their market into different territories and to make a lot of money as they do this sort of thing. Now, James is addressing this kind of in a negative fashion, but we've got to understand this is not James munching on granola and holding up an Occupy sign that denounces capitalism in general. I don't believe that's his point. I think his point here isn't that there's something inherently wrong with owning a business or making a profit or something like that. His point seems to be more about the hubris of assumption. The example that he uses here is actually quite comprehensive. It's a sweeping picture of a person's life. He deals with time and purpose and place and goals and rewards. All of those things that go into all of the plans that we make. How we're going to use our time, where we're going to do these things, the rewards we're looking for, and the point that he's making on this is that it's all approached from the perspective of control, as though somehow we have control over these things. And I can't think of a description that's more apropos for our present society than this, because it's epidemic in our culture to be overextended in our commitments and stressed out all the time because of time, as though we somehow are in control of the time that's here. 21st century Americans have been described aptly as being busy, dissatisfied, and compulsive people. And I think that's a pretty accurate picture of us. Like Louis C.K. says, everything's amazing, but nobody's happy. And James's solution, again, settles on humility. He settles into this idea of humility here. A humility that comes with the knowledge that we're like a morning fog. You ever go out on the beach in the morning when there's like a thick fog and it just feels like it's intensive, like it just encompasses everything and it settles over everything and it dampens the sounds and it just feels so all pervasive, and yet 9:30 in the morning and it's gone. It's as impactful as it was at that moment. It dissipates very quickly. And that's what James is trying to say here, that there's a temporal nature to this, a recognition. He's trying to point out to us the short nature of our lives, a recognition that time and events are not ultimately ours to control. So when we think about this in terms of how this is going to affect our approach to life, how does this affect our approach to life knowing this? Well, I think what we get here is that we gain a better view of life when we acknowledge that life is temporal. It is temporal. That's an important step in learning to appreciate our present moments. Learning to appreciate something like this, where we're all gathered in a room and we're friends and we're family and we care about each other, and this is very important. Oftentimes we spend times like this thinking about the very next thing that's got to be done, as opposed to just taking a deep breath and realizing God is here and everything is good. Appreciating those moments. So the point seems to be here that each day's 24 hours are not ours, O-U-R-S, necessarily, or automatically. God controls time, and he provides it to us as a gift. God controls our time as well. Our culture doesn't like to think about, honestly, our culture is pathological in its denial about the temporal nature of life. I was watching a TV ad the other day for life insurance, and the guy's going on about the benefits that the family will receive. He says, if the unthinkable happens. And I started thinking about the unthinkable. He's not saying that right. He needs to say when the inevitable happens, this is what can happen for your family as well. But we act as though this is unthinkable. It's unthinkable to, you know, we're funny people like that. We fret and we stress about things that there's no possible way we could know at all. What's going to happen to this nation after the election? Is going to be this or that? And we're stressed out over things that we have no idea about. There's no certainty to whatsoever. But we treat something like the end of life, which is absolutely certain, as though it's just this unthinkable possibility that could happen somewhere along the way. It's certain. It's certain. Rob, this is awfully morose for a Sunday morning. I mean, I was hoping for happier things, and I realize it could be kind of morose, but James's point is not to get us dour or down. His purpose here is to redirect our thinking so that it affects our priorities and our values about how we're living our lives. If we really believed that life is a gift from God and that we're not in control of the time of our life, it would have a profound effect on how we prioritize things, what things we place value on, wouldn't it? Steve Jobs, you know who he is, right? He was the founder of Apple. He passed away just recently, but before he passed away, he was quoted as saying this, and I thought this was profound. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. You know, what James is trying to do is to get us to understand those values right there without having to have a diagnosis in front of it, without having to have a doctor's report that tells us something. We're given this opportunity to recognize that life is here for this span and we have to make the most of it. And you think about that. I mean, what would you do if somebody did come to you and say, listen, you've got 2 hours on this plane. What would you do? What would the first thing be that you'd want to do if you knew you only had 2 hours left here? Anybody brave? Anybody want to say? What would you do? What? Family. You'd think about family. I would. I sure would. I'd also want to get a second opinion real quick in those 2 hours, but that's just me. But after that, absolutely. I mean, those are the things we attach ourselves to. We zone in like our place with God, and we think about those people that we love and those relationships that we have because we intrinsically know that those things are eternal and of eternal value. It's so important to remember those things. And yet, so often we live our lives and we push those important things off into the margins because we're so busy pursuing a career or buzzing through the busyness of our day. Sometimes our children can grow up right behind us while we're busy clutching at the wind. But we can make the most of our right now by remembering that right now is all we have for sure. And so we put a high priority on the good that endures forever and not just stay enslaved to the urgency of a busy life. Now, I want to qualify here, you know, this is not intended. When we're talking about this and we understand, you know, that we're making the most of our right now, I don't believe James is intending this, and I certainly don't want to intend to get us getting all morose and, you know, oh, I'm just never going to make any plans at all. You know, hey, what are you guys going to do tomorrow? I don't know. I may not even be alive. I don't know. So lunch is out then, I guess. That's not what James is trying to inspire. No, there's a proper place for making plans and setting goals and pursuing dreams that we may have, but there's a qualifier to the whole thing. That's what he's trying to get across. There's a qualifier, and he gets to that qualifier here starting in verse 15. He said, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and we'll do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. Now, it's not that James, so you didn't want people making plans. Obviously, we can't live like that. You know, you call the doctor. Yeah, well, do you want to set up an appointment? No, I don't make appointments, man. I just live in the moment. You know, maybe your doctor should be found at the Rainbow Festival or something like that. But even though we have to make a plan, even though it's important that we make plans in life, we want to make plans in light of our limited view and our partial information. We just don't know for sure what the future holds. So we gain a better view of life when we plan in light of God's will. That he's got a plan and a purpose unfolding here. John Wesley, he was a great English preacher from the 1700s. He was the founder of the Methodist Church, or at least the Methodist Church was founded on his teachings. And in every letter of correspondence that he would write, as he would detail what his plans were in terms of coming to a different town to speak or do something like that, he would always put the capital letters DV next to it. And it's an interesting thing, because DV actually stood for Deo Volente, which is Latin for God willing. In each plan that Wesley made, he made sure that he threw his own qualifier in there, reminding himself, God willing. Keeping in mind that God's got a plan and a purpose playing out in life is key to dispelling our nagging compulsion and propensity to act as though we're self-sufficient somehow. Like this is all up to us and we can make this thing happen and make it go the way we want. And it also alleviates the stress that we can feel when things aren't falling into place the way that we'd imagine them. We can rest in the fact that God's doing something. So that whether our little plans are working out or not, we know, we can rest and say, you know what, God's up to something. God's doing something in this, and apparently it's not what I was going to do. It wasn't my idea, but no matter what, his plans are working out what's best for us. Because we quote that over and over again, Romans 8:28. Everything, all these things in life are working together for our good, for what's best for us, whether we understand that right now or not. So instead of just rushing ahead with no other thought besides what it is that we want or what it is that we desire, we do well to remember that God's got a plan unfolding in all of this. And our highest good is to cooperate with whatever it is that he's doing. It isn't a bad idea to even start each day saying that, God, what do you have planned today? I want in on that. What do you have going on today, God? I want to do that. That'd be a good sign to put on the mirror, right? As you start the day, you know, rubbing the sleep out of the eyes, trying to, you know, poke the boogers out of the corners there. And just when we get our focus, we look at that. Oh, yeah, God, what do you have going on today? I want in on that. I want to do that to find my place in God's plan. You know, that's the thing. That's our highest good, to find our place in God's plan and cooperate with that. How much energy do we expend on making all of our little plans and getting God to try to sign off on it? Constantly. God, I need this dream job. I want this dream. I just gotta have it. Please, please, God, just do this thing. Come on. Time's a ticking. We gotta get on with this thing. How much healthier, how much more content would we be as human beings to just instead say, God, what are you up to today? I want in on this thing. You love this world. You love me. I want to work with you. I want to be a part of this story. What is my part of the story, God? I want to fulfill that. And so if that means that I get the job or the house or whatever it is that I'm looking for, then I'll do that for you and with you, God. But if it means that I don't get those things that I've been wanting so badly, then I'll do that for you and with you, God, whatever this is that you're unfolding here. I'll take up my part in the story and I'll just trust that you're writing me well. There's a great deal of contentment associated with that. How much more peace-filled is that as an approach to life than some of our frantic attempts to get God on our plans? And you know, look, we got a lot of habits. We got a lot of years of habits of self-sufficiency. So when we say these kinds of things, we're not saying that, you know, so tomorrow morning you should wake up and have this all figured out. Not at all. This is going to take time. This is stuff that takes time as we go. Attitude change like this doesn't happen overnight, but it's a goal worth aiming for, right? It's a goal for us to keep in mind and to aim for on a regular basis, to move in that direction. All right, well, wow, finishing up this morning. I'll tell you what, I'll extend this part because I don't want you guys to get used to getting out of here quick. Here's what he says in verse 17. So whoever knows to do the right thing, whoever knows the right thing to do, there we go, and fails to do it, for him, it is a sin. It is sin. Now, this verse has been a little bit puzzling because it kind of just drops in there. It doesn't feel like, I mean, it seems like it jumps track in terms of the subject matter, but he's actually on the same idea. This is all connected with what he's been saying here. He's just adding another element to consider in light of the context that he's set up here, keeping in mind that life is temporal and that we need to make our plans with God's will in view. Then James tries to reinforce the urgency of doing the right thing when we have choices to make. There's a reason why there's an urgency there, because life is temporal and we don't know what's unfolding there. He talks about failing to do the right thing, and he calls it a sin. It's typically been called a sin of omission. And we've got to understand, when we use that phrase of sin, we need to understand the concept. This isn't James shaking his finger at us like the church later saying, or something like that. But this word literally means to miss the mark. That's what sin is talking about. It misses the mark. It comes up short is the idea. We could say, yes, it comes up short of God's holiness and his righteousness, but it's even more than that as well. It comes up short in terms of life. He's saying that if we fail to do the right thing when we're presented with the choice to do it, we come up short. We haven't lived this life for everything that it's worth. And I think we could actually say that we gain a better view of life when we revere every opportunity to do good. When we take every opportunity that's presented to us to do good, to do the good that endures, and treat it reverentially, make sure that we act on it. I don't know about you, but I've had a lot of opportunities to do good for someone in this life, and I've let it slip away by not acting on it. And it's never been, as far as I know, out of malice or indifference. It's usually just been because I've been busy. I've got an opportunity to do good, and I let it slip because I think, well, I'll get to it later. But you know, that opportunity doesn't come back again. Sometimes it's been because I've been religious. I've allowed things to happen or done things that I felt like I was, you know, important, doing important stuff for God. And I missed opportunities that don't come back again because I've just been so busy with my religious agendas. And here, this is James telling us that in the bigger picture, the reality that each time the opportunity arises to demonstrate grace or to show kindness or love, to advance the kingdom through showing the reality of God at work in this world, every opportunity that arises like that could very well be our last opportunity. It may be the last time we get to do something like that. We just don't know. Every opportunity then becomes very, very precious, something to be revered. What if you knew, like we said before, when the last moment was going to be? The other question is then, what legacy would I want to leave behind here? What would I want people to remember? If we can learn to see each chance to do the good that endures as possibly our last chance to change this world, to make a difference in this world, it may change the way we prioritize doing good. It may actually help us diffuse some of those senses of urgency of the busyness that we're involved in and realize what's really important here. It may mean I get delayed. It may mean something else has to be put aside so that I can focus on doing the good, doing the right thing here. But what kind of a difference do I want to make in this world, and what kind of a legacy do I want to leave behind? Because God's got a plan for our lives. God's got a life that he wanted us to live, to express. And this is part of it. This is what it's a part of. And when we push those opportunities aside, we let something else claim importance over us, James is saying we're missing the mark. You know, it means we're not obeying God's plan, but it actually means something to us very personally here in this. We missed the mark in terms of the life that we could be living. Ephesians 2:10 tells us that we were created to do good. And you think about that phrase. We were created, that's what Paul says, we were created to do good. And really, we're hardwired to do good. I realize that sin and the things that have gone wrong in this whole thing have corrupted that. So it doesn't pan out or play out the way it's supposed to. But when you get down to the nuts and bolts of our wiring, we're wired to do good. And there's actually research that corroborates that right now. The studies show that there is what appears to be, they've dubbed it the helper's high, that people experience when they're aiding other people or doing good deeds. Studies done at the National Institute of Health have shown that helping others triggers our brain to reward us in certain ways that can only be explained as being hardwired into us. Volunteers in one study were asked to imagine two scenarios, keeping a large amount of cash for themselves or giving it away to needy people. And the more generous scenario activated a primitive part of the brain. And that means that it wasn't something consciously activated there. It wasn't something chosen or whatever, but it's that hardwired thing, that reflexive sort of reaction. It usually lights up in response to food or sex, and they've dubbed it the helper's high. We're hardwired this way. One professor concluded it's illuminating the way in which human beings are inherently wired for moral decision making. Cultivating, and this guy that's writing this is a professor. He's not religious. There's no agenda that way. Here's what he said. Cultivating loving kindness and compassion leads to a greater sense of well-being based on the way our brains work. Think about that for a minute. We're hardwired to do this. We were created, Paul said, to do good. We were created. We're fulfilled when we're doing good. We're prioritizing what God prioritizes, and that is people. And caring about people and loving people and demonstrating his grace in this world. Doing good is a means to living that whole life that God envisioned for us. A whole life, a complete life. The life that God designed for us to experience here. And all of our lesser selfish efforts to live that good life, all of those ways in which we claw around and scrabble through all of the ruins here to try to piece something together that we think is going to be fulfilling in some way. All of that keeps us so busy and so self-focused and so distracted from the needs around us. And it keeps us from the one thing that is actually going to reward us and make us whole and fulfilled in this life. Submitting to God's plan and taking on our part to do good and make a difference in this world, that is where life is found. That's where we have that sense, that knowledge that we are significant, that there's meaning and there's purpose to every breath that we draw because we're fulfilling what it is God made us to be, God intended us to do. But it requires a change in our point of view. It demands a surrender of control on our part. And listen, we're not quick to give up those controls. That's a hard-fought battle there, but even though it's stuff that takes time, it's so worth it to begin those practices of release, to let those things go into God's hands and find that wholeness that comes from moving into cooperation and in harmony with what it is that God's doing in this world, God's good stuff that he's doing. So let's set out on that path. Let's acknowledge that. You know, we're here today. We're all alive. I think we're all alive. We're hanging out here together. God is here in the midst of us. Everything is good right here. Let's set out on this path and make that determination that we're going to understand and recognize, yes, this life is temporal. We're going to make our decisions with God's purposes in mind, but we're also going to make the most of every opportunity that comes our way to do the good that endures, to make the most of this so that we live that whole life. Now, normally what we do here when we close is we speak a blessing and we dismiss and stuff. But this morning I'd actually like to do something a little different. There was a minister at the turn of the century named Reinhold Niebuhr who was a minister, but he was also a social activist. Some fundamentalists had a problem with him because of that, but I really believe he did some very important stuff in the cause of the kingdom of God. I felt like he was a profound influence there. Anyway, he wrote a prayer that really fits what we've been talking about today. And it's a prayer. It was modified and adopted by various recovery groups, and it's used on a regular basis in their meetings. But if you don't mind, what I'd like to do is I'd like to have us stand together and read this prayer in its entirety, in its original format. It's a longer prayer than what many know. And what I'd like us to do is that when we pray this prayer together today, let's make this the beginning of our commitment. Yeah, you can go ahead and stand up if you will. Let's make this the beginning of our commitment to really put into practice what we've heard here today. That there's someone in control and we can trust him. that he loves us and he loves this world. And he's got something unfolding here, and we want to cooperate with that. But it means that we're going to surrender this control. We're going to give this into his hands. And we're going to believe that he's working out all things for our good. We're going to take our part in this story. Does that sound like a plan? All right, very cool. Well, then we'll pray this prayer together, and then you guys can feel free to bail out. If you want prayer for anything, feel free to come on up. We'd love to pray with you. Don't forget there's going to be a meeting with Kelly and Mike here in between services. We'd love for you to get involved in the Connections Coordinators ministry that's opening up here. So let's pray this prayer together, and we can be dismissed. God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things which should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. In Jesus' name, amen. Go in peace, you children of God.